For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from their first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. This portion of WGTD's morning show features a very special treat for Packer fans. And the treat is really the wonderful book that has been created by Mark Beach, a book called The People's Team, an illustrated history of the Green Bay Packers. And this is an amazing book. And actually, as you first glance at it, it looks like your typical coffee table book with tons and tons of photographs and maybe some captions and a couple of essays. But actually, this is a meticulous history of the Green Bay Packers and a thorough telling of one of the most inspiring stories in the history of professional football, and for that matter, one of the most inspiring stories in the history of organized sports in general. And Mark Beach brings significant credentials to the table. For many, many years, he was a writer at Sports Illustrated and is now a senior editor at the Players Tribune. And he lived for a time in Milwaukee and so experienced up close and personal, as they say, the rabid devotion of Wisconsinites to the Green Bay Packers. And I think it's fair to say that there are fans of the Packers actually all over the country. They are a special team with a special story, and that story is told wonderfully well in this brand new book published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, again titled The People's Team, An Illustrated History of the Green Bay Packers. And Mark Beach, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks very much. It's awesome to be here. That was thank you very much for that introduction. It was a labor, more than 2 years in the making. But I'm glad that the book has come out and looks so nice and is touching people so much.
And explain for people who aren't quite as well acquainted with Packer history as you are or I might be, why it is great that this book is coming out in the year 2019. Explain why this is a banner year in terms of Green Bay Packer history.
Well, the Packers actually celebrated their 100th season of football last year in 2018, but they didn't turn 100 until August 11th this year. So this is they're now 100 years old. And, the S&P 500 wasn't even around when the Packers were created. It came around a few years later. But the average lifespan of a company there was 65 to 75 years. And now it's even shorter. It's only 15. And the Packers have been around for a century and show no signs of being gone anytime in the next century. So I think it's really, it's an amazing thing that they survived and continue to thrive in the smallest town, and what has almost always been the smallest town in pro football.
You quote extensively in the foreword to the book and talk extensively about a gentleman by the name of Cliff Kristol, who has a very special relationship to the Green Bay Packers. And I dare say much of his work was instrumental in this book being the work of art that it is. Explain to our listeners who Cliff Kristol is and the role he played in this book.
Well, Cliff Kristol was a 27-year-old reporter at the Green Bay Press Gazette, I think in 1971, when the managing editor of the Press Gazette called him in and made him the beat writer for the Green Bay Packers and told him, to cover the team like any reporter at any big city paper. Until then, the Press Gazette and the Packers had a very symbiotic, you know, close relationship. You know, Andrew Turnbull, who was instrumental in saving the Packers back in the 20s, the business manager of the Press Gazette, famously told one of his reporters, be nice when you cover this team, because if we're not, they might not be around much longer. In 71, Cliff was a reporter who was told to cover them for real, which was an important turning point for the team and for the paper. And for the next 36 or 37 years, Cliff was at, you know, three other papers in Wisconsin, a pretty great sports writer, a diligent reporter, it's scrupulously honest and unmerciful sometimes in his evaluation of things. And in 2014, to the Packers' great credit, they hired him to be their historian. And he brought every bit of diligence that he brought to his job as a newspaper man to his job as a historian for the team. And his columns for the Packers have been a great debunker of myths, a great telling of lost tales, a great place to find information on your, you know, what probably is your favorite team if you're on the team website. Without Cliff, the history I was telling had largely been set straight, in large part because of what Cliff had done, you know, for the last 5 years for the team. But he'd really been gathering string on the Packers' history since the mid-90s.
Hmm. Your book is thorough to the point that chapter one is titled Two Sides of the River and really takes us back to before there was a city called Green Bay. And it's really amazing. And I am so glad that you make the choice to take that long a historical view of this team. And I think it's especially intriguing to see this title, Two Sides of the River. You chose that with care because you believe that to have been really instrumental. That is kind of a across the river, two sides of the river rivalry that, in a sense, helped shape what would be Green Bay and ultimately the Green Bay Packers.
Right. I mean, the Packers are not only tied up in the people of Green Bay, but they're tied up in the land itself. That is part of their history from the very beginning, all the way into the 20th century when they tried to practice outside Green Bay and live outside Green Bay at Rockwood Lodge, on the bluffs overlooking Green Bay on the Door County Peninsula. The two sides of the river, if you live in Green Bay, the more important body of water to you is not the bay itself, it's the Fox River, which divides the east side of town from the west side of town. And in the, you know, before the Packers came around, it divided Green Bay proper from Fort Howard and Howard, you know, the west side. And there was a rivalry between the two towns that went way back. The earliest I could find on what was the source of it was the rivalry over where the railroad would go. And for it to take a western turn, they determined that Fort Howard was the better place to have the railroad run. And Green Bay promptly built the Walnut Street Bridge across the Fox River. It was the first span across the Fox River in Green Bay. And the rivalry really goes back to, that's the 1860s. And the two sides of the town were really striving against each other in a lot of ways. And that gave rise to the rivalry between Green Bay East and Green Bay West High School, which was really, Curly Lambeau was a star at Green Bay East, was the source of the birth of the Packers. Most of the guys who played on the first two teams in Green Bay for the Packers were graduates of those two schools. The rivalry was intense. They played on Thanksgiving Day every year. One year, you know, it got so bad that the state militia was patrolling the sideline trying to keep order amongst the fans, who took it very seriously. And so Green Bay was a football town going way back. And Curly Lambeau saw that and thought, might be a good place to start a pro football team. Nobody had any idea it would grow into what it did, but certainly Green Bay's affinity for football, which grew out of the land itself, was a source of that.
We're speaking with Mark Beach about his wonderful brand-new book called The People's Team, An Illustrated History of the Green Bay Packers. At the time that the Packers became something of an organized franchise in 1919, this was a time when organized football was not all that organized. And in those early years, you describe the low rent reputation of pro football. The game and the men who played it were perceived as vulgar and dishonest. Just say a quick word about the way football was very, very different from the game it would become just a few years later.
Yeah, you know, well, the NFL was created to deal with some problems that, pro football was having. At the time, it was called the APFA. I think it was the Association of Professional Football. I'm going to blank on a full acronym, but that you know, the players themselves would play for different teams from week to week. They were, you know, available to the highest bidder. Teams would frequently, when they had a big game coming up against a rival, they would buy up players in the area just to make sure they couldn't play for the other team. And they had a tremendous problem with college players. College players knew the game. They were good, and they had experience, and teams would hire college players to play for them on the weekend. And that was really not a very popular thing with the public or the media. And pro football came in for a lot of criticism for that. And it, for that reason, it was perceived as a less honest, honorable game than say, college football, which, as we all know, has a lot of problems of its own. But back then, pro football was perceived as the ne'er-do-well of the football, you know, of the football world.
Right.
Because of its use of college players. And the Packers, their first year in the NFL, they were actually kicked out at the end of the season because they used college players in the game.
Right. You tell us something so intriguing, and this involves now then the legendary Curly Lambeau, is that the Packers are indeed excluded from the league in which they were playing, and Curly Lambeau was instrumental in the Green Bay Packers sort of scratching and clawing their way back into pro football as a reorganized team, and he managed to make himself the head of it. You tell us that the story of how Curly Lambeau managed to secure control of the franchise is, in your words, a story that falls under the category of too good to check. I think we're talking about something that in around which a lot of myth and legend has sprung up. What would be the short version of the closest thing to the real truth that we can get about this crucial moment in Packer history?
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing. Curly Lambeau, I think, got the Packers reinstated. They were kicked out of the NFL in January of 1922, and he got them reinstated in June of that year, and really made them wholly his. But to do that, the legend grew up, and Arch Ward wrote in his very entertaining history of the Packers, written in 1946, Arch Ward, sports editor of the Chicago Tribune, that Curly Lambeau had gone to the meeting. I think it was in Ohio, and he'd borrowed his friend's cream-colored Marmon Roadster. He borrowed his car and sold it to get the money to pay the Packers' entry fee back into the league. I can find no evidence of that. I can find no evidence that Curly Lambeau went to the meeting with anybody but himself in 1922 in June. And it just, there's so many odd things about it. Like, it just didn't add up in so many ways. And there's no record of this ever happening. You know, Lambeau came back, he left and came back alone, according to the Press Gazette. There was nobody else with him when they noted that he'd gone with a friend to the meeting in January. So that seemed odd in itself. It's a great story that he sold a car to raise the money, but nobody knows actually how much money the Packers paid to get back in the league. The NFL kept no record of it, and there's no record of it at the Pro Football Hall of Fame.
Interesting.
So nobody knows that, you know, going back to when the Packers' first year in the NFL, there's a $50 price scrawled on the side of their franchise certificate, but nobody knows who put that there or when. Because there's no record then either of the Packers paying any money to get into the NFL. So they probably paid some money, but nobody knows how much.
Wow.
There was at the time a $1,000 retainer teams had to pay that they would lose if they used college players. So the Packers had to have put up that money, but But there's no record of it, and nobody knows where Lambeau got the money or how that came about.
Hmm. One of the great stories from these early days involves someone whose name I did not know till I read your book, the name Rigney Dwyer. And you tell the story of Mr. Dwyer in part because it's a story that turns tragic. And the wake of that tragedy that befell Mr. Dwyer was, in your words, the first of a number of pivotal moments that both forged and strengthened the bond between the team and the community. Tell our listeners who Rigney Dwyer was, what happened to him, and how his story, sad though it is, ultimately made a difference in the way that this city cared about the Green Bay Packers.
Sure. Rigney Dwyer was the son of a railroad man who, you know, worked for the Milwaukee Road. His brothers did. He was a graduate of Green Bay West. He played football there and been a star. I think he had a big interception return in one of the rivalry games in a victory over East at one point. He was married. He was a veteran of World War One, and he was an end on the first two Packers teams in 1919 to 1920. And the week of Thanksgiving, at 3 o'clock in the morning, he was working his regular job. You know, all the Packers had regular jobs at that point. He was working his regular job as a switchman in the yard of the Milwaukee Road. And the switchman was just the railroad was a tremendously dangerous job back then. It was, you know, lost fingers and toes were, you know, those were, you know, if you worked in the rail yards, that probably you had lost a finger or toe at some point. And Rigney at 3 o'clock in the morning fell beneath a moving rail car and wound up losing his left arm and his left leg at pretty much all of both limbs. It was a horrible accident. But it for want of a better word, it galvanized the city of Green Bay. His recuperation was covered extensively in the paper, in the Green Bay Press Gazette. And the Packers actually organized a benefit game for him that raised. They played it in December after the season was over. It was an intra-squad game. But a bunch of people came out thousands of people came out to Hagemeister Park to watch, and they raised the equivalent of $50,000, all of which, because they set it up as a charity, went to Rigney Dwyer. It was an amazing thing to raise that much money back then. And it really, if you're looking for a ground zero moment for when the Packers went from being just another one of the town teams, albeit one that had stuck around for two consecutive years, which was a rarity, when they went from being just another town team to being something that the people of Green Bay cared more intimately about, it was then.
Hmm.
Really, the benefit game for Rigney Dwyer is the moment when the Packers and the people started to have a special relationship.
Right. You tell us, in your words, Green Bay's journey to Titletown, USA, meaning their journey to transcendent greatness, began in the summer of 1929. Briefly, I'm afraid, tell us what Curly Lambeau managed to accomplish starting in the summer of 1929 that changed everything, that changed the Packers from a good team into an incredibly great team.
You know, Curly Lambeau doesn't get enough credit, I don't think, as one of the great personnel men of the early days of pro football. And in the offseason of 1929, he went out and signed halfback Johnny Blood, tackle Cal Hubbard, and guard Mike Mikulski. All three of those guys are in the Hall of Fame. The Packers already had a very good player named Vern Llewellyn, who was a punter and a halfback, and a terrific, you know, he scored a lot of touchdowns and did a lot of things for the team. But the Packers went from being good, they'd never had a losing season, to being a dominant team. And they won the next three NFL championships, 29, 30, and 31, all of which were decided by the standings. So they did it by winning. And they won a lot in those 3 years. And that was that moment. I think it started in late June, maybe late July. I'm blanking here a little bit. But that was the moment when he signed those three guys that really turned Green Bay into a juggernaut.
And, of course, in your book, we can read about that first glory period for the Green Bay Packers. And then, of course, it is safe to say that the glory evaporates. And by the mid-1950s, the Packers could probably be accurately described as one of the worst teams in the NFL. And then, of course, somebody named Vince Lombardi comes around to dramatically turn things around. Very briefly, what went wrong? And then what are the most crucial things that Vince Lombardi did to rebuild the Packers into the glorious franchise that they had been?
What went wrong was Curly Lambeau's act began to wear thin in Green Bay. You know, the Packers had one losing season until 1948. They had one losing season in their history. It's remarkable. They were just a really, really good team, or a pretty good team, for a long time, and they won a lot of championships. But in 48, Curly Lambeau was being perceived as having gone Hollywood. He was married and divorced three times. He had young girlfriends. He was known as a womanizer. And when the Packers started to lose, that really started to grate on people. He'd also purchased Rockwood Lodge way outside of town, which was a lousy football facility, despite his grand designs for it. It started to be a financial drain on the Packers, and the executive committee started to usurp authority from him. And in 1950, that came to a head, and he resigned to take over as coach of the Chicago Cardinals. And the Packers were low on money. They had to sell stock again and play a benefit game to save themselves in 1949 and 1950. And it worked, but they were in danger of leaving town, of the Green Bay was in danger of losing its team. The Milwaukee Braves were setting attendance records at County Stadium, and people were wondering why the Packers weren't playing there, people around the country. So when Vince Lombardi got there, they'd been down for, I think they pretty much had a losing season or never finished above 500 every year between 1948 and 1958. And when Vince Lombardi got there, he was like, I'm in charge. I'm the one guy in charge. He was a magnificent teacher, but he was also a magnificent tone setter, if you want, for the organization. He redid the offices, designed new uniforms, kind of wiped the slate clean and started over with the Packers would be his own thing. And that really was what began the, era of glory in the 1960s.
Right. And I appreciate the fact that even for people who are fairly casual fans of pro football and know something about those glory years of Vince Lombardi, there is still a lot to learn from exactly what Vince Lombardi did with this team and some of the crucial figures that made that incredible era possible. And then, of course, some years later, and particularly told in a chapter called Resurrection, we read about the Packers doing it again on the arm of Brett Favre and other great players of that generation, and this incredible story goes on. As you began writing about this history, what kind of personal experience did you expect it to be? I mean, I suspect that you were more than just kind of a clinical journalist and historian, that this for you is also a personal story to some extent of your own connection with this franchise and its history.
Sure. I mean, I'm bound by the same cables that people from Wisconsin are all bound to the Packers. They're there for me. They exist. And so for that way, I had more than a passing interest in the Packers and their story. When I came to it, I figured 100 years, it's a fairly easy story to tell. You start at the beginning and you go all the way to the end. But what I didn't realize was that the early history of the team, that they're really just is not, there weren't many good books out there about it. There weren't many good, reliable sources of information. There are some books out there, but they repeat a lot of the same mistakes or make a lot of the same assumptions conspiracy theories. And it was tough to find a good history. And that's why Cliff's work for Packers.com was so valuable. John Chirinos' book, former Green Bay Press Gazette managing editor, had written a memoir that was, I don't think factually rigorous, was, you know, it told the general story, and it told it fairly well. So there was some good stuff out there, but it was a lot more to untangle than I thought. I went into it a little bit naively, and you know, the pleasure of doing the research and plowing up this ground was finding out how deep the connection is between the Packers and the city of Green Bay. I mean, the Packers co-founder, George Whitney Calhoun, is a grandson of the founder of the city of Green Bay, Daniel Whitney, which it amazes me. The Packers really do go all the way back, and I felt their story needed a serious, sober, and thorough retelling.
Right. You say at one point in the book, more than any other team in any other sport, the Green Bay Packers are of the place from which they come. And I think your book is a wonderful telling of that particular story and many others tied up in the history of this franchise. The book is again titled The People's Team, An Illustrated History of the Green Bay Packers, lavishly illustrated. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, the author Mark Beach. Mark Beach, congratulations on a terrific book, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Oh, thank you so much. It was great to be here.
You're listening to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. To finish out today's program, we go back 10 years in the archives to my interview with John Eisenberg, the author of one of the most interesting books about football that I have ever read, titled That First Season, How Vince Lombardi Took the Worst Team in the NFL and Set It on a Path to Glory. That team, of course, is the Green Bay Packers. And one of the things I said to John Eisenberg as I introduced him 10 years ago was that this strikes me as a book that would be of great interest, not just to Packer fans, but just to football fans in general, and even not to just football fans, but to just anybody who enjoys the story of an amazing turnaround. And that certainly was the story with the Green Bay Packers and the dramatic turnaround which they enjoyed under Vince Lombardi, a coach who at that point in time when hired by the Packers had never been a head coach at either the college or pro level. Here is a portion of our conversation. One of the things I most love about your book is just the very concept of it. That is that I think if you put a bunch of people in a room and tried to come up with ideas for great books, most of us would think of things like the first time the Green Bay Packers won the Super Bowl, or the first time the Pittsburgh Steelers won the Super Bowl, or those kind of moments of where greatness is first achieved. This book is really not quite about that. It's about something a little bit different and in many respects far more interesting. Talk about that distinction.
Well, thank you. Where the idea came from pretty much was, I'm a sports writer by trade and have been for many years. I'm a sports historian. I'm a fan. And like anyone who follows football a little bit, I knew all about the Lombardi Packers and knew about the championship games that they won and the Super Bowls and the great games, the Ice Bowl. I've seen the films, read the books. And I thought, wow, you know, those are all great, enjoyed them very much. But I was doing some research, and I happened to come across some statistics pointing to the state of the Packers before he got there. And I was just astounded at sort of the low ebb that they were, where they were at that time, that the year before he got there, they won just one game, and that 3 years before he got there, they were still playing at East High School. And, you know, their season ticket base, they probably had 10 or 11,000 paying customers. But yet on that one, that team that won one game in 1958 was Bart Starr, Jim Taylor, Paul Hornung, Ray Nitschke, Jim Ringo, Jerry Kramer, seven future Hall of Famers.
So it's not like they were a bunch of nobodies with no talent.
No, no. So I thought, well, I think people know those stories of the great games, but I think there was an untold portion of the Lombardi dynasty. If I didn't know about it, I thought, well, I hoped that other people didn't know about it, and the turnaround story at the beginning of his era, I thought was something new and fresh, at least from a historical perspective. So I embarked on the process. And of course,
you're doing so in this 50th anniversary year. That is the 50th anniversary of Vince Lombardi, beginning with the Packers.
Right, right. And that was by design. That's the book publishing industry. It was, 50 years ago, and so it was targeted for that.
Hmm. And fortunately, as we certainly learn in reading your books, and more specifically in the acknowledgments, although many of the key players, literally and otherwise, are no longer with us, there are many of them who still are, and you were able to talk with them, and that is what gives this book such a sense of immediacy, that you are not just looking at newspaper clippings and so on, but actually talk to some of the Packers on the field, on the sidelines, who were part of this momentous turnaround season.
Yes, I did. I went around the country interviewing them, and I considered it a privilege. It was fun. Who wouldn't to sit down with Bart Starr and to sit down with Jim Taylor and Paul Hornung and a lot of the linemen from that era, maybe not quite as well known, Bob Skowronski, Norm Masters, Bobby Dillon is still the career interceptions leader for the Packers, played in the 50s. So, yes, I interviewed all of them, and I knew I had a good book on my hands. I know they'd been asked a lot of questions about Lombardi over the years, and they love talking about him. But I knew I had a fresh question on my hands. You know, I would say, do you remember the first time that you met Lombardi? And there would be this long pause. They all had the same response, this long pause, and then they would start smiling to themselves, and then they would chuckle, and then they would say, oh, yeah. I remember the first time I met Lombardi, and there was always, then they would impart a story in which he had, something he had yelled at them. Now, this is like the first time he'd yelled at them or set the law down on some rule that they were going to be had to adhere to from now on, and so he was tough on them from the very beginning, and they remember the early time vividly.
Right. Well, particularly because it was such a drastic change from the very loose sort of operation which had been in place before, which is one of the reasons they had fallen on such hard times. I mean, this was a new era in almost every sense of the word, and of course people would have pretty vivid memories of their first run-in with that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Scooter McLean, the coach that was there the year before him, with a 1-1 game, had been an assistant for 7 years, and he was sort of the good cop on the staff, the assistant coach. He would play poker with the guys after curfew, and they all took his money. They loved Scooter, and he would, if practice would go, he would make them run wind sprints at the end of practice. They'd say, oh, Scooter, come on, these are hard. We got a game coming up. He'd say, oh, you're right, fellas, let's stop. And so there was almost no discipline at all, none. And I think that you could see the effects of that on the field. And Lombardi came in, and suddenly there were all these rules and just an incredible amount of discipline. I mean, if you weren't in bed with lights out at 11, you were fined. If you were caught standing at a bar, you were fine. Just standing at the bar.
Even drinking ginger ale, he said.
Even drinking ginger ale. So numerous, and that doesn't even, I'm not even going into, the training camp was just grueling and rigorous. They were going to be in physical shape. So just a number of ways he changed the entire culture immediately from the day he got to town.
We're speaking with John Eisenberg. We're talking about his book, That First Season, How Vince Lombardi Took the Worst Team in the NFL and Set It on the Path to Glory. This is not primarily what your book is about, but I hope you won't mind if we just spend a minute or two talking about the early history of the Packers. I'm so glad that you include some of this here, again, because I meant sincerely what I said earlier, that I don't think you have to be a fan of the Packers or even a fan of football to necessarily find this book really, really interesting, because it's this human story of turning something around. But it really helps to understand what Vince Lombardi did if we have a little bit of history about this particular team, the Green Bay Packers. And in particular, what set them apart even 50 years ago from the typical NFL team. Talk a moment about this sort of small city, big city divide between the Packers and most of their competitors in the NFL.
Well, certainly the Packers were dated back to the origins of pro football, right after World War One, when pro football started up. It was kind of like pro wrestling. Not nearly as popular, but it wasn't considered a serious sport in many respects by most people. College football was much more popular, and pro football sprung up in a lot of Midwestern industrial towns, smaller towns. It wasn't a big city venture at all. And so there were these sort of scrappy teams. The Packers were one of them that played before a few thousand fans. It was not a big deal. The Packers had one of the better histories in that era. They started winning championships in the late 20s and through the 30s. And it started to grow, obviously, and cities started to have teams in New York and Chicago. And the Packers continued to do fairly well through that era. But once all the small town teams sort of died out, every one of them except the Packers, who managed to continue to exist, and it became, pro football became a big city venture, the New York Giants, Chicago Bears, and then teams in Cleveland, Los Angeles, Washington, and the Packers. Suddenly there was a disparity after World War II. When the sport began to take off, and these other teams were playing in large stadiums in big cities, L.A. Coliseum, there's 100,000 people there, and the Packers were at East High School with 15,000, and they were lucky, and they started to lose. They didn't have as much money. There was no revenue sharing in the league, and they had very little. Once TV came in, a small TV contract, so they were at a competitive disadvantage. And they lost throughout the 1950s, lost badly year after year. And there was some talk that they might have to leave Green Bay because the people in the league just couldn't see them getting out of this tailspin. It was hard to imagine with they had a great history, but nothing else going for them as these other teams moved ahead. So really, Lombardi came to town at a crucial juncture in the history of the franchise. And it's not a huge stretch to say that he may well have saved the franchise.
Hmm. You point out a couple of things which made these rotten years even more rotten, or I mean even harder for the players to live through. One of them, you talk about how the citizens of Green Bay really loved this dynamic of their hometown team taking on rivals from these huge American cities. I mean, it made them even more anxious for their beloved Packers to win. And there were points at times when that happened, but that stopped happening at some point, of course, which was really painful. You point out something else that I thought was fascinating, and that is that there were plenty of retired Packers from the glory years who had married local women and settled there right in Green Bay. You tell us the police chief played on the 1919 team. The fire chief had played with the great Johnny Blood. 24 former players lived nearby and attended games. Reminders of better times were everywhere. I think that's probably an often overlooked component in how the downturn of the Packers was especially painful for those players experiencing it directly.
Without a doubt, it's not like today when these players jump from city to city and they live in Florida in the off season or California or Texas, somewhere where the weather's warm. These were residents, and this was a time when, football players were not wealthy men. They were working class people like everybody else, and they had jobs while they played during the off season. They had careers after they finished playing, and they were just part of the community. They weren't really any different than anyone else. But in Green Bay, especially as the present became more and more sort of depressing, I guess would be the word, they really clung to the past, and they treasured the past. The Packers did have a great history, and it made the people of Green Bay incredibly proud to know that the big Chicago Bears came to town. There was a period of time when the Bears came to town, and the team from Green Bay whipped them, And the people of Green Bay just treasured that. That was really all they had because the team in its current state was not good. So they loved their history.
One issue besides the sort of lax culture, which you've already mentioned, is the fact that the Green Bay Packers organization was set up in rather laborious fashion. Tell us the way in which this team was managed and the way in which that really had to be drastically overhauled before this team was going to be able to function a bit better.
Yes, well, of course, as your listeners know, they're owned then as now by the community, people that own shares in the team, a publicly held company, and that public, those shareholders would vote in a board of directors, about 45 people back then. The board of directors would vote on and elect an executive committee that ran the team. The executive committee back in the era just before Lombardi was 13 people. It was a large group, and they ran the team. Once Curly Lambeau, of course, was the famous figure who got the Packers started and was their figurehead, their main guy for 30 years, and he got crossways with them after a while, largely over money, and quit in the late 40s. Throughout the 50s, the executive committee really ran the team in a very heavy-handed style. Once Curly, the major figure, was out of the way, they had a committee for everything, a committee for game programs, a committee for contracts, a committee for coaching, and all this stuff. So it was really a team run by committees. And like a lot of any business run by committee, most people will tell you, it wasn't too effective. There was a lot of bumping into each other and a lot of butting into the affairs of the on-field product, which was self-defeating. And every Monday after a game, the coach had to put on his coat and trundle over to the Northland Hotel. You know, he'd been watching film, and sit down with the executive committee and just take their questions, a lot of which, it was a grilling. They would be grilled on Mondays. And so, it was not easy to be the coach. It was not just wasn't a streamlined, effective organization. But all that had changed by the time Lombardi got there. A lot of people think, well, Lombardi came in and changed that. The reality is, in 1958, as they were watching this unfold, the people running it said, this is not working, and so we need to streamline this. And they had voted to change from 13 people to 7 on the executive committee, and to also let football people run the team. They did that before Lombardi came in there. It so happened that Lombardi stepped into that situation. Very fortunate for him. But it is true that the executive committee had decided before that to sort of change the way they did business.
Right. You cite team president Dominic Olenzak as one of the people who realized that the Packers needed to function differently if they were ever going to taste the success they'd had before. Your book actually begins with what in many respects is the lowest point of this low period, a 56-0 thrashing. I can't remember now at the hands of what team.
Baltimore Colts.
Ah. And you tell us that the day after that loss, the coach, Scooter McLean, as was usually the case, was watching films of the game, and you said, the films were a horror show. Sitting in a dark room as the projector whirred, Scooter saw that, as he suspected, some players had simply quit.
Yep.
So that was what we were talking about. I mean, a team that was lacked discipline to that extent that they not only, in many respects, lacked the ability or physical wherewithal to get the job done, but their heart just simply wasn't in it. I mean, in a way that's probably, relatively unthinkable in professional sports.
Well, I had to be very careful when I wrote that passage for obvious reasons. No player 50 years hence or whatever wants to be known as someone who quit in a game. So I ran this by a lot of people before I wrote that. And, some people didn't want to name names. Yes, there was definitely, during that game in the second half, raining, they were in Baltimore just getting massacred by Johnny Unitas, and there were some people that just sort of bagged it. And you know, it was actually Art Daly in the Green Bay Press Gazette wrote that the next day. You know, that it was the biggest quit, you know, quotes in quotes, the biggest quit in Packer history.
Wow. And ultimately this season ends 1-10-1, the worst season record in Packers history. Obviously, a change needs to occur at the top once the sort of the organizational structure of the team has been changed. And ultimately, the man brought in is Vince Lombardi, who learned the business of football and sort of forged his own coaching style from a couple of different teams and with a couple of different people with which he'd worked. Tell us what was most important about Vince Lombardi's experience in football before coming to the Packers. What shaped him?
Well, he had been a high school coach in New Jersey and then 5 years at Army under Red Blake, who was a legendary coach back then, and then 5 years as the offensive assistant for the New York Giants. And I think if I had to say which of those informed his style the most, it would be the 5 years with Red Blake. Red Blake was really Lombardi's mentor in football. And Red Blake, he coached at a service academy, and a lot of those teams, you know, as you might imagine, his style made the most of what you could get at a service academy, which was a lot of discipline, a lot of organization, an emphasis on fundamentals, nothing really fancy, great effort, you know, simple, straight-ahead football, executed well, and executed and practiced until it was executed well. Lombardi was really, really affected by that, and when he came to the Giants, he put a lot of that in motion as an offensive assistant. A lot of those pros didn't like it. You know, they weren't getting paid enough money to get yelled at is what they thought. And but ultimately became a very, very effective style with the Giants, and he put his own things. He tweaked to Red Blake's system. He was an offensive innovator, an X's and O's guy, and he had some fun. Blending the pass with the run and trick plays like the halfback pass and things like that. And so when he got to Green Bay, he had 5 years in the pros sort of as an assistant, tweaking a system that had really sprang, it really came from his time at Army. And then he added to the final piece of the puzzle was his ability to lead, which I think was sort of intrinsic. You know, that was his personality. And once he had a team in under his thumb, once he had his own team, then that's when his powers of leadership sort of came to the fore. And those, I think, were just a natural. That's who he was.
Author John Eisenberg and his wonderful book about the Green Bay Packers and their dramatic turnaround under the legendary Vince Lombardi is a book titled That First Season, How Vince Lombardi Took the Worst Team in the NFL and Set It on a Path to Glory. I'm Gregory Berg. The interview that you just heard an excerpt from, John Eisenberg, and That First Season, will be shared in its entirety as part of one of this weekend's podcast editions of The Morning Show. So watch for that if you would like to hear more about Vince Lombardi's dramatic first season with the Green Bay Packers. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Jessica DeBoer will give us a preview of this upcoming season of Fine Arts at First United Methodist Church in Kenosha. On Monday, you'll hear the interview that I recorded with a 2017 Carthage grad named Matt Tomey, a former voice student of mine who has actually gone on to enjoy some great success in the world of sports management. Right now, he is employed with the Sacramento Kings. On Tuesday, a war historian from Elmhurst, Illinois, talks about his fascinating book, The Hidden Places of World War II. Next Wednesday, Dr. Art Sear offers his thoughts on current events. And next Thursday, Nan Calvert brings with her P.J. Leash, who is with the entomology department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. It's archived at WGTD.org and also available as a podcast. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. Learn more